This is Rumblestrip. I'm Erica Heilman.
Most people are freaked out by these snails.
I have to say that I'm a little freaked out by these snails.
Well, maybe...
Do you judge me for that? Does that make you think less of me?
No, but maybe once we talk about them, they'll become endearing to you, as they are to me.
That's my friend Brian Pfeiffer. He's a writer and field naturalist in Montpelier, Vermont. And no, the snails did not become more endearing to me. But I love talking with Brian about what he finds in the woods. It's like being with a 7-year-old who caught something and put it in a glass jar with a bunch of leaves, if this 7-year-old was also an expert in birds and butterflies and dragonflies and plants and a lot of other things we wonder about in nature. Brian has retained his 7-year-old exuberance. He's one of those rare grown-ups who can still sit at the kids' table. Recently, Brian published an article about his discovery of these crazy zombie snails whose eye stalks have been taken over by long, wet, pulsing technicolor appendages. Anyway, here's Brian Pfeiffer.
I was out walking the dog, Odin, named for a Norse god. And we're just walking, I'm botanizing, and I look down and I see one of these amber snails, these land snails, really common brown snails that are widely distributed around the world, actually. And the tentacles are flashing and pulsing with green and brown stripes, and they're rhythmically moving in and out. And I look at this thing, I say, like, to Odin, I said, like, what the f- is this? I had no clue. I actually sent some photos to colleagues, one of whom knew immediately what it was and was really envious of my find. He said, I've been looking for these. I really wanted to see this. It turns out that the snail is occupied by a developing stage of a flatworm, a trematode, in the genus Leucochloridium. Okay.
Oh, good God, does that sound dirty? Right. I mean, the whole thing.
The snail is a zombie snail, and those pulsing tentacles are like disco pulsing zombie snail projections, and that this flatworm, that which I'll get to in a minute because its life is crazy, has commandeered the snail and is taking control of its mind.
So you're already, you've said occupying its mind.
Yes.
That sounds like anthropomorphizing.
It is, but I used the word occupy instead of infected, for example. These are parasitic flatworms. This one goes by this sort of unceremonious name of green-banded broodsack, which really doesn't say a lot.
It all says
to
too
me.
Much,
it
all
says
of these
too much.
Words.
Right. These flatworms, they live the entirety of their adult life inside a bird's guts or its cloaca. Okay. So it's like the intestinal tract of a bird. And they range in size from maybe the size of a sesame seed to a grain of rice, like a short grain of rice. And they're flattened. And they basically have two like sucking parts opening, like mouth parts. They're feeding on like slime and food and other gross stuff inside of a bird. Gross to us, wonderful to them. It's how they live. And it never goes outside.
So
it lives out in the world as an adult.
It is, that is where it is having its peak experience then. It is having a whole life there, and that is as happy or as sad as it gets for that worm.
No, I mean, the important thing is its whole life is not there. Inside the snails are another phase of its life. But as an adult worm, like being an adult, reproducing, they're hermaphroditic, so they can fertilize themselves or fertilize another trematode flatworm inside, and they then produce eggs. But those eggs don't grow up to adult flatworms inside the bird. What happens is the only way that this flatworm gets outside of a bird is when it takes a crap, and those eggs end up in the world in bird crap. Okay. And the eggs, probably the vast majority of the cases, end of the line for flatworm lineage. But every once in a while, birds crap on leaves, and wandering by on the leaf is one of these amber snails. And they're gleaning, and they're not very discriminating in their diets, right? So like if they wander by some bird shit, they're gonna eat bird shit, and they will ingest these eggs inadvertently. From the egg, there hatches kind of what amounts to kind of like a swimming, tiny larval stage of the flatworm. And basically, once this thing hatches, this stage of the flatworm is free to move about the snail. And then it goes through these different stages of growth, right? So like this myracidium grows into this thing called a sporocyst. And don't worry about the terminology, but it's this kind of like wiry growth inside the snail. And this is the key thing. The sporocyst itself has like developing little larvae, little trematode babies, if you will. So from this sporocyst, there grows this caterpillar-like structure called a brood sac. It looks like a striped sausage, and it's growing in, you're making a face. It's growing inside the snail.
But it's fancy. It's not, these are not subtle colors. These are disco colors.
Think striped caterpillar, like ornate caterpillar.
So how's the snail doing?
Snail, we don't know. How's the snail doing? They're just going about their business. We don't know how they feel. I wish I could know.
I don't think it's a hard leap to think it's not pleasant for the snail.
I'm going to reserve judgment on that. I don't know. So what happens is the immature stage of the flatworm can only continue the rest of its life cycle back inside the bird's gut. It needs to get from the snail back into the bird's gut. The snail is the ride. But here's the thing. Songbirds don't eat snails. So what the developing flatworm inside the snail does is this brood sac makes its way. Think of it like a pulsing worm that's moving around inside the snail.
It is pornographic. I'm sorry, but that is what it is. Hard to not. It is a pulsing, wet appendage.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. So what it does is it moves into the snail's eye stems, like these tentacle projections that come off a snail's head. And it does its thing. It pulses in and out. It flashes. It's very showy. And presumably, it's really attractive to a bird. They're eating moth caterpillars for the most part and other insect larvae. Well, this thing looks like a caterpillar. And they pluck the pulsing brood sac out of the snail's eye stem.
So now it's an even edible.
It becomes... I've read, I don't know for sure, I think it is the case, the snails can regenerate their lost eye stems. They don't come back perfect, I think, you know? But the key thing is the developing stage of the flatworm has now returned to a bird. And it can continue to develop and go on to become an adult trematode, flatworm, and continue the life cycle. Lay eggs again.
So it lives in darkness as a mature creature. It lives in darkness, but it seeks light as a nubile.
Absolutely. It does not see the light of day. It lives the entirety of its life inside of a snail and inside of bird guts. That's it. That's the entirety of its life. So like, think about that the next time you're stuck at the office, you know, or you're like forced to have dinner with the in-laws, you know, like this organism doesn't get out into the world. I mean, the only way it gets out into the world is in bird shit, you know, as eggs.
So does this pulsing flatworm give you hope? Why do you care? Why do you care?
Well, I think it's an intellectual, mostly it begins as an intellectual curiosity. I know birds, and I've seen these little amber snails all over the place, but I had never seen these pulsing brood sacs inside of amber snails. And once I did, I was wondering, okay, well, what is it? Then suddenly I learn of a relationship between birds and these snails. There's like satisfaction in knowing that for me. Life, the evolution of life, the story that we try to understand when we look at nature is a story that is very old, that predates us by a long time, but it's a story that we, as, you know, bipedal with big brains and intelligence most of the time, are writing. Like, we're writing the story of life on Earth. And this is one tiny bit of that story. So, I don't know. I guess that's the story of life. And then there are these little things that on my walks I can look for every day.
You've spent the majority of your life in this relationship to nature. It's what you've done. It's what you do. And if you don't anthropomorphize it, I think anthropomorphification for some people makes them feel closer to an elephant. Yeah. It makes them feel closer, but in many ways that kind of anthropomorphification is distancing, because that thing becomes simply a narrative, our own narrative. But,
right. You think it can be good? I mean, I think there's a role for anthropomorphizing in nature. If it brings us closer to nature.
That's a kind of like, it's like first base with nature is to anthropomorphize.
Yeah,
when you're going to second base for somebody who hasn't had, there is a different kind of relationship where you don't ask from it to be part of your story in some way, or even part of what you can understand.
Right.
But you're dealing with sentience that is not familiar to you, but there can be love. There can be love in that circumstance, but it takes a little bit more something.
Some of it is more some of it we manufacture, and some of it I believe is genuine. And I can give you an example. There are these dragonflies that are called darners. They're the big, long, people call them devil's darning needles. They're marked in these pastel blues and greens and yellows, and they're big, and they circle around the edges of ponds or bogs where I like to hang out, bog ponds. And these dragonflies basically got it right 300 million years ago, and they haven't really changed much since. So they've been around a long time. And I stand there at the edge of the pond with my net waiting to catch them. And they come around, and I'm standing there, and one of these dragonflies will stop and see me. It'll register to the dragonfly like, wait a minute, what the heck is this thing standing here, right, with a big net? And it stops, and it looks at me. It hovers in place and looks at me. And I look at it, and it is definitely looking at me. It's basically thinking, do I want to kill this thing and eat it? Do I want to have sex with it, or is it trying to kill me? That's basically what's going on in the dragonfly's neurons. That's all I need. Like, I don't need it to think that it's, you know, it recognizes who I am or
it doesn't
what
have,
my business is.
It doesn't have to love you.
It does not. It just has to look at me, you know, with those big eyes. And I have to look at that and I say, wow, I have come face to face with 300 million years of evolution. That's good enough for me. In spite of all of the abuses that we perpetrate on nature and how much we destroy, it doesn't know of political tribalism. It suffers from it. It doesn't know of pandemics and wars. It just goes about its business. And that includes a brood sac pulsing in a snail's eye stems. And it's no different than going to the Grand Canyon or to the mountains or to sitting beside the ocean and watching the waves. You know, like, I can sit by a plant and watch this snail, and it's my shelter and it's my refuge, you know. But we should go look at the samples that I brought you. They're kind of sitting, oh, here they are. So I had them in a jar, right? Here they are. They've climbed up onto this leaf.
Oh my gosh.
Right? There they are pulsing.
Oh. I don't know. It's like a...
Well,
that's the sound that it would make if it could.
No, it would have a disco beat.
That was field naturalist and writer Brian Pfeiffer. You can find a link to his article about these zombie snails on his Substack, which is called chasing nature. He also has video of this thing at the end of that same article, which you really owe it to yourself to check out. You can also find all of these links at vermontpublic.org/rumblestrip. You've been listening to Rumblestrip, distributed on the radio by Vermont Public. I'll be back next week. This is Rumblestrip. I'm Erica Heilman. Thanks a lot for listening.